This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget, can you hear me now? The question of the day is, can they hear me now? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 6th of June. Good as always to have you with us. And a couple of points about this Verizon NSA story as we get going today. Number one, the Obama administration won't confirm it's true, but the White House does say reviewing phone records is a, quote, critical tool in fighting terrorism. Item number two, at least two members of the United States Senate said today that this surveillance has been going on for 7 years, and essentially, they added, what's the big deal? There is no shortage of angles on this story, political, legal, ethical, and corporate as well. Here's another one, practical. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains what the government does with all this data once it gets a hold of it.
This is an unfathomable amount of information, so big it's worth little without a tip on where to look. Stuart Baker is the NSA's former top lawyer. Say the U.S. gets intelligence that a known bad guy in Yemen said this to somebody.
Tomorrow at 11, our guys in the U.S. are going to call you on your other phone. They're going to just give you a phone number, go to the market, buy a new phone, call that other number at 2.
A scan of all that data could find a person whose call records match that scenario.
That's highly likely to be somebody who's tied to Al-Qaeda.
Baker says it's not clear what rules the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court has laid out as to who can get permission to look into this database or how deeply they can dig. But even eager data miners marvel that the order requires Verizon to give the NSA information on all its calls. Will Regal helps companies use data to reach customers.
I was surprised at the breadth of it.
But just like in the corporate world, you're going to get a lot more out of a big pile of data if you narrow it down.
All of a sudden, we're not talking about a week's worth of data. We're talking about a 10, 20, 30-minute period of time that you're examining.
Then you translate your question into a formula that goes into the data and looks for answers. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The particular part of the Patriot Act that gives the government permission to go after this kind of data is called the business records section. So we thought we'd explore that business part, what else companies might do with the records of hours that they have. Fatima Kadablu is a senior analyst at Forrester Research. Fatima, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So on the theory that they have this data to give to the government, what does Verizon do with all this metadata, this transactional stuff? Do they just sit on it?
No, I think this is data that they're using for their own some tracking purposes, but it's also data that they use for billing. It's data that they use to understand patterns. It's data that they use to identify new locations for towers, that sort of thing as well.
And as they use this, can they monetize it?
Well, they haven't done so yet, but certainly there are potential opportunities for that. If the government gives them rights to start monetizing this data, there's plenty of people who'd be really interested in where you shop and how you're shopping and, you know, if they could get the geolocation data, which store you're going to from Best Buy and after Macy's and so on.
Of course, the catch would be, oh, no, you can't do that because of privacy concerns, right?
Yeah, you bet.
And don't you love that?
Uh-huh.
It can't just be Verizon that has data that would be useful to the government in its security concerns, as they say it is with this data. I imagine that Amazon, for one, has piles of it. Google, oh, my goodness, has piles of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, the first thing I'll say is it's really unlikely that Verizon is the only carrier that has this order. But on top of that, I think when you look at companies like Twitter, these guys are collecting all kinds of networking data, which is really ultimately what the government is looking for.
The whole thing does kind of remind me of that old saying from Scott McNeely of Sun Microsystems, you have no privacy, get over it.
Yeah, I don't think that I buy that yet. I think we might be in the dark ages of privacy, but I do think there's a renaissance to come. Consumers, as they become more aware of this, as they become more aware of how their data is being mm-hmm. used, they're going to be more interested in why it's being used and who's got access to it. And I think we will actually get to be a little bit smarter. The challenge for me with this kind of surveillance is I think the whole Boston Marathon bombing was sort of a tipping point for surveillance. We saw the use of government surveillance and the government using closed circuit TVs to find the bombers. Yeah. And I think that people like that. People are glad that those guys were caught.
How do you see this playing out? Do you think it spurs outrage among consumers, or does it get a collective shrug?
I think it's going to be a very verbal outcry from a minority, but I think ultimately we end up shrugging. We'll probably look more to the government to fix this than we're going to hold Verizon's feet to the fire. And I think that's a shame, because we really could get Verizon and other companies to get a little bit smarter and to be more consumer advocacy oriented if we held their feet to the fire.
Fatima Kadablu at Forrester Research. Fatima, thanks a bunch.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
If the NSA had been spying on Wall Street today, they'd have been smiling. All three major indices worked their way back to positive territory on this Thursday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The new Vince Vaughn, Owen Wilson movie opens on Friday. The Internship, it's called, or as it's come to be known, the Google movie, because Vaughn and Wilson play two 40-somethings who get laid off and then land internships at Google. The company did cooperate in real life, but it is still a big Hollywood production, so get ready for all the revelations about how being an intern in the movies isn't the same as it is in real life. But that doesn't mean there's no truth on the screen at all. Marketplace's Queenie Kim explains.
I saw a screening of the movie recently in a theater full of Google interns.
Are interns in the house?
And I didn't see a gray hair among them. What I did see were a lot of heads wearing beanies with bright Google colors and a blue propeller on top. Of course, the propeller hat is a geek cliche, and it looked like something made for Hollywood. But Raymond Braun, who works in the marketing department at Google and was an intern, says that that's the one part of the movie that rang true.
One thing in the film that is completely accurate is that hat. It's exactly the same one that I wore.
It's called the Noogler hat, and that's what new Googlers are called. And it's given to all new employees, including interns. Do you still have your hat?
I do, of course. It's like a badge of honor.
Doug Edwards is the author of I'm Feeling Lucky, The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59.
For a period of time, I was running TGIF, which is the weekly meeting that Google holds for all of its employees.
That was back in the early 2000s. And in those days, Google co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin would personally introduce each new employee.
And it was important to Sergey that the new Googlers would be easily identified so that current Googlers could make sure they felt welcome.
At the time, Edwards was one of the few non-engineers at Google. He suggested a propeller hat.
To me, it was hilariously funny to see all these PhDs walking around in beanie propellers.
What was meant to be a tongue-in-cheek joke has taken on a bigger meaning. Marcin Vihare is an ex-Googler. He was a designer there until last year. And he remembers the first time he saw his Noogler hat on display in the permanent collection at the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley.
Holy crap, that's my hat! And now it's in this container as an artifact.
Vihare says his hat reminded him that it's okay to be a geek. And that's part of the symbolism of the hat, according to Mark Weber, the curator of the Computer History Museum.
Instead of marking someone as separate and not with it or cool, it's marking them as being a member of this exclusive group.
He says it's a lot like the kind of rituals you'll find at elite universities, where they have traditions and symbols that make students feel special. So if you want one of those Noogler hats, you can't just buy it. You have to earn it. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
Ken Lennox, our rancher guy out in Rolla, Missouri, that we talk to every now and then, is just home from the big cattle sale he goes to about this time every year. So we figured we'd give him a call and check in. Mr. Lennox, good to have you back.
Yes, good to hear from you.
So it's cattle sale season, I understand. How's the market?
The market was down some, especially to what it was last year. But it was still, you know, good enough to say it wasn't a bad year.
Well, so give me a sense. I mean, what does that mean? You go, you're taking your cattle to market, and what are you getting?
Well, it was a little under $1.50, so about 40 cents down.
That's a lot. That's no small drop.
Yeah.
All right, so roll it out for me. What does that mean for you then?
Well, it means you don't, you may not build a new barn or buy a new vehicle, but, you know, I'm not losing money at that. I don't mean to say that. We're not out of the cattle business by a long shot.
Who's doing the buying? I mean, where are your cattle going to wind up?
Well, there were 76 in one bunch, and I think the man that bought them's going to Iowa. And then some of the rest of them went to Kansas, Nebraska.
But once they get to Iowa, Nebraska, wherever they're going, are these now breeder cattle or are they going to be hamburger?
They're going to be steaks, hopefully, a lot of steaks, and then the rest of the roasts and hamburger. They should be some of the very best.
One hopes, right?
Yeah. Now, your most of your hamburger comes from cows, the old cows that are through producing.
Oh.
I sold a few light heifers. They may go back to somebody's farm, I think.
Pricing's down for you, but, you know, if you go to the supermarket, I had heard beef was getting more expensive, no?
Yes, it is. It depends on how much it costs to put on a pound of beef, because they know what they're going to get at the end, and they don't want to have more dollars in them than they're going to get out of them in the end.
No, of course, but how do they know what they're going to get out of them in the end?
Well, they can plug the futures in, the future markets.
Oh, man.
And they can lock in the corn price. They can lock in the sale price of the finished cattle, because these ones that went to town weighing 600 pounds for me, they're going to have to get another 500 to 600 pounds put on them. And the cost of that 500 or 600 pounds will determine what their profit is.
Yeah, of course. And so these guys are playing the futures market, right? They're watching those futures prices, trying to lock it in, and then they're going to figure out how much they can afford to feed these guys to get them up to the weight they need to be.
That's exactly right. They may not do it on everything, but they may gamble on some. Now, when it comes to us down here, we're gambling on everything every year.
Ken Lennox out in Rolla, Missouri. Mr. Lennox, thanks very much for your time, sir. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you.
Coming up, graduation day to Euler is a big, big deal.
People come, whether they have kids here or not, just to sit and watch because high school graduation was not a part of the culture down here.
Our Amy Scott wraps up her series, but first, let's do the numbers. Traders seesawed their way to an upbeat close today. The Dow Industrials added 80 points, about 0.5%, closed back over that 15,000 mark, 15,040 to be precise. The NASDAQ up 22 points, about 0.2%, landed at 3424. The S&P 500 gained 13 points, 0.8%, ended at 1622. Apple peeled off 1.5% today. Ciena, maker of phone carrier equipment, soared 17% on better-than-expected sales. Verifone tumbled 20%. The credit card terminal maker's forecast was substantially lower than analysts had expected. Costco up 1.75% today on stronger-than-predicted sales at its club warehouse stores. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.08%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, a look at the length of the unemployment lines. The Labor Department releases its monthly jobs report for May. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to issue consumer credit data for April. And tomorrow is National Donut Day. Control, people. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Diplomatic and Economic Center of the Universe comes here to Southern California tomorrow. President Obama and Chinese leader Xi Jinping are going to go out to the desert resorts east of L.A. for a couple of days worth of bonding. All right, that's overstating it, perhaps. But the White House has been clear in its hopes that a less formal setting outside Washington, that is, will be more likely to produce results on a whole raft of thorny issues. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has this rundown of the relationship between the world's two biggest economies.
First, what's not working in the relationship between the U.S. and China?
Cybersecurity.
Patrick Shavonik is chief strategist at Silvercrest Asset Management. He says reports that China's military stole terabytes of secret data from U.S. businesses will be at the top of President Obama's agenda.
It has emerged very rapidly as an existential threat to the U.S., both in economic and in military terms.
Shavonik says getting President Xi to acknowledge this is a problem would be considered a success for the U.S. But first, Xi will want to bring up what's not working for China.
China has reason to believe that the U.S. doesn't trust rising China and that the U.S. is trying to restrain or contain China.
Fudan University's Xin Chang says President Xi will be looking for a more open dialogue on China's territorial disputes with its neighbors. President Xi is also seeking help to make it easier for Chinese companies to invest in the United States without creating panic in Congress. It may seem like a big to-do list for both sides, but there's hope, because what is working between the U.S. and China is the direction China's economy is headed, says Patrick Shavonik.
Where Chinese leaders are increasingly realizing that China's economy needs to go is exactly where U.S. leaders want it to go.
Remember the fury over China manipulating its currency to keep its exports cheap? Not an issue anymore, says Shavonik. China's appreciated its currency to curb inflation, and that's made U.S. products more affordable for the world's largest rising consumer class, a situation both sides are sure to be happy about. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We're working on a series that's going to start on Monday called Consumed. It's about the consumer economy, why we consume the way we do, what it gets us and what it costs us. It's going to be good. It's going to be interesting, and you should listen to it. But that's not why I bring it up right now. There's a report out today from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute about what happens to the stuff in our consumer economy. They've been sending submersibles down to the ocean floor for the past 22 years, keeping track of every piece of trash they found along the way. Cans, tires, chairs, a coffee table, shoes, always shoes in singles, never in pairs. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
The Monterey Bay region is probably the most studied part of the ocean floor on Earth. The Aquarium Research Institute there has been using ROVs, or remote operated vehicles, to film about 200 undersea surveys a year.
However, we've only looked at less than 1% of the seafloor.
Susan Von Toon at the Research Institute says that in just that 7 square miles, they discovered more than 1,100 pieces of trash, including one lonely shoe. Jesse Thorne is the host of the menswear show Put This On.
Well, it's definitely a blucher.
A blucher is a kind of loafer with laces.
Which would make it maybe like a rock port or something like that.
It looks like it might be something like a rock port.
That's Megan Cleary. She calls herself America's shoe expert. She and Thorne both looked at a photo of the shoe on the ocean floor, and it's ironic that they identified it as a rock port because there's a rock fish living in it.
These animals are now living in an area that they wouldn't normally be able to live, and if we then removed the debris, it would then disrupt their habitat.
But chances are no one is going to evict that poor rockfish from the rock port, because it would cost a fortune.
It costs anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 a day. It would be really expensive to try to clean up all of this debris in the deep sea.
Von Toon says that the best thing to do is prevent debris from getting into the ocean in the first place. Because it takes so long for things to decompose in the deep sea, that shoe and all that other sea junk could be there for centuries. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
This next couple of weeks are pretty much it for the school year in most parts of the country. And so comes the end of our series about Euler School out in Cincinnati. Our education correspondent Amy Scott has been roaming the halls at Euler since last September because they're doing public education differently there. Euler is more than just a school. It's a neighborhood health clinic and vision center. It's got mental health counselors and college advisors and hundreds of volunteer mentors as well. All of it aimed at breaking the cycle of poverty in the neighborhood and building a culture where high school graduation means something. And that gets us to the moment they've been working toward all year out at Euler. Here's Amy.
It's just a few hours till graduation, and Principal Craig Hockenberry steps out for one of his last walks around the neighborhood before the school year ends.
What's up, Nate?
He shakes hands with the postman making his rounds.
Graduation tonight.
Okey-dokey.
Big party. Yeah. Big party on State Street.
The neighborhood is looking good. Crews of volunteers have been clearing out trash and old tires. Hockenberry spots a row of brick houses being painted.
We need every house done like this.
Along the way, neighbors and former students try to score tickets to the ceremony.
Stop over, man. I'll get you in if you want to watch it.
Euler is gearing up for a crowd. This is only the fourth official class to graduate from the high school. Before Euler added the upper grades and all the community services, very few kids from the neighborhood got diplomas. Jamie Lugan is the school's resource coordinator.
People come, whether they have kids here or not, just to sit and watch because high school graduation was not a part of the culture down here. And they just come to see, like, the success of the kids of the neighborhood.
Hockenberry says graduation can get rowdy.
It makes me feel a little uncomfortable because I always think of these as very solemn, but I also got to remember that this is more than just the child graduating. This is the day that eluded their mothers, their fathers, their grandparents, and everybody else. So have fun, Lower Price Hill.
And Lower Price Hill does not disappoint. At 5 o'clock, the seniors file into Euler's stately Art Deco auditorium. The young men in black caps and gowns, the women in silver. A mom crouches in front to snap pictures. Principal Hockenberry takes the podium.
It is my pleasure and my honor to welcome you all to Euler School, the pride of Cincinnati Public.
The pride of Cincinnati Public. It's how he answers the phone, signs his emails. It's all part of Hockenberry's campaign to turn things around at Euler, the reality and the perception.
There was a lot of lack of pride in this community, in this neighborhood. And I personally believe if you say something enough, that you slowly start to believe it.
As students have made steady progress on test scores, he says people don't laugh anymore. But he knows Euler has a long way to go. It's ranked in the bottom 5% of schools in the state, partly because its official graduation rate, the percentage of kids who start in ninth grade and finish in 4 years, is so low, less than 36% last year. But of those who make it to senior year, the majority cross the finish line, 41 students this year. One by one, they walk across the stage to collect their diplomas. In a back corner, the Gribbins family erupts. Raven's father, grandfather, and grandmother all went to Euler. None of them finished school. A week before graduation, Raven was accepted at Penn State's Greater Allegheny campus. She wants to study math and education. There's still the very real question of how to pay for it. Even after grants and government loans, she still needs to come up with $11,000 for next year, which probably means more debt. She sees it as the price of a better life.
If you don't have a college degree, you're always living paycheck to paycheck, struggling. And then you always end up doing something you don't want to do. So when you go get your degree, then you can do what you like to do.
Most of Raven's classmates plan to attend at least some college. A few are headed for apprenticeships or trade school. About a third will go straight into the workforce. But a lot can happen over the summer. Just before the ceremony, Hockenberry ran into one of his most promising seniors from last year. College didn't work out.
I see kids that graduated from Euler that just, they didn't make it. So now, instead of being a dropout, they're walking the streets and doing drugs with a diploma. And we don't want that to happen. We got a million success stories, but, you know, we don't want to lose anybody.
After the ceremony, everyone pours out onto Hatmaker Street. A few families fire up some barbecues for a cookout in the parking lot. The celebration is tinged with sadness. The night before, an Euler parent with kids in preschool and kindergarten was shot and killed in front of his house. Hockenberry says there's less violent crime in the neighborhood since the school reopened this year after a renovation, but it's never far away.
So even though, you know, we make a lot of progress here, we take steps back often, and that's the challenge here in the inner city, so.
He'll be back next year to take up the challenge again. A few months ago, his job was on the line because of a budget gap. The district renewed his contract with a pay cut. He's already cooking up plans for next year, a dental clinic inside the school and a barber shop. And as we talk for the last time this school year, another idea takes shape.
It's almost like we need an office of post-secondary, you know what I mean? Like to follow the kids, especially now that we're in the hundreds, you know?
Kids who a decade ago may never have finished high school. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So that's it for the radio stories. But Amy's year-long exploration of what's happening at Euler lives on our website. Profiles of students and teachers, a history of the school, the yearbook as well. Check it out, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which carbonated water features prominently. The big Wall Street story early today was about a company called SodaStream. It sells a gizmo that lets you turn tap water into fizzy drinks, for lack of a better word. Rumors were that Pepsi was going to buy the thing for $2 billion. Things got so effervescent. That Pepsi CEO Indra Nooyi personally came out and said the rumors were false. Shares of SodaStream up 78% the past 6 months, in part because you think of all the plastic bottles of soda water that don't get used, speaking, as we will be next week, of the consumer economy. All right, we're going. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Thursday. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I am Kai Rizdahl, and we will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.